Okay. Well, let me start by thanking organizers, although not all of them are here, for putting up this wonderful conference, and has been extremely inspiring to hear all the wonderful talks. So today I'm going to talk about some recent work we've done on this new type of faces in three dimensions, the Fredcon faces. They also exist in lower dimensions, but I'm going to focus on three dimensions. So we've heard a lot about exotic quantum faces in this conference, and the kind of quantum faces that I'm interested in, at least in this talk, are those that have well-defined quantum particles. Now, we also know that there are faces without well-defined quantum particles, without well-defined quantum particles, but I'm going to just think about quantum particles which are fractionalized, so they are not your local electrons or bosons, but they're still well-defined. So these quantum particles are non-local, and this usually occurs when there's an emergent gauge structure. I mean, probably all of them. So it means that at low energy, you can at least think of a lot of low energy states in terms of these well-defined quantum particles, which are weakly interacting with each other. And oftentimes, you can label the different types of quantum particles you have in your system by just some letters, for example. And here I'm making an assumption that quantum particle excitations are localized in some sense, which usually means there's a gap to quantum particle excitations, or there could be other excitations which are gapless. But again, these are non-local excitations, so you cannot make them locally. Okay. So for example, one way to create such a quantum particle excitation is to apply some kind of string operator to your ground state. And the string is invisible, so what you end up with is just a two endpoint. You get two excitations at endpoint. So these excitations are excitations are localized in terms of energy density, but they're not local. Okay, so of course, the most well-known example, or probably first example for many of us, is the toric code. So here I'm just showing the Zn version of toric code, where on each edge you have a Zn rotor. So you have X and Z, which are the shift and the clock operators. And they satisfy this algebra. And then you just put the usual sort of terms. You have a Plaquet term on each Plaquet. And then you have a vertex term. Okay, you can view this as a Zn gauge theory, where the vertex term implements a Gauss law, and the Plaquet term just enforces zero flux in each Plaquet. And in such a model, so this model is exactly solvable, all terms commute. In such a model, you can create two types of excitations. One of them is just a violation of the vertex term, and that we call E excitation. And you can create that by just applying a string of Z along the edge of the lattice. Okay. Another type of excitation is a flux, which is a violation of the Plaquet term, which can be created by applying a string of X along the dual lattice, along a path on a dual lattice. So another example, which will also sort of feature in the talk, is that we can also have gapless phase, but with well-defined quantum particles. And the well-known example is the 3+1 U1 or Maxwell gauge theory with gapped electric or magnetic charges. Okay, so it's a compact U1 gauge theory, but with gapped charge excitations. So if you go up in energy, at low energy, all you have are just gapless photons, and you just see the Maxwell electrodynamics at low energy, and then above a certain gap, you start to have these charge excitations. Okay. So I'll loosely refer to this as topological order as well. Okay, so you've heard two talks by Xie and Andre on fractal faces. So these are topological order faces in three dimensions. I mean, I'll just talk about three dimensions, where you have quantum particle excitations with reduced mobility. Okay, so quantum particle excitations with subdimensional mobility, so it could be no mobility at all. These are Fredcon excitations, or depending on which dimensionality they can move, you call them 1D or 2D, and now they have names like planons means particles that can move in 2D, or linons, that particles that move in 1D. Okay, but Fredcon just refers to particles that cannot move at all. Should probably call them pointons, but I think we should blame Liang Fu for creating that name. Anyway, so we know that Fractal models are gapped, topologically ordered, at least locally, but they have in many ways they are very different from the sort of more conventional notion of topological order. I've just listed one of them. I mean, apart from the subdimensional excitations, that these models, for example, have sub-extensive ground state degeneracy if you put it on torus, for example, and then you also have sub-extensive entanglement entropy, et cetera. So there are many ways that they depart from the sort of old school topological order. Okay. So what's really important to me is that it means we should think of a reduced mobility as a topological phenomenon. I mean, it's a combination of kinematics, which is really topological, has a topological arranging, plus energetics. But this is an aspect of topological order that has been overlooked. Okay, so of course we have now lots of models, so many exactly solvable models stabilize the codes. Unfortunately, this is the only slide with the introduction. But so you have probably heard about XQ models, and of course Haar's code, etc. So there's a long list of models, and you can work out phenomenology in each model case by case, and we understand a lot of them. But of course, we want to have some sort of better way to capture the underlying structure. I mean, if there's any structure. Okay. So especially for the type 1 models, so for those models that don't have anything fractal going on, there has been many progress. For example, there's this tensor gauge theory framework, largely due to Michael Preckel. And more recently, it's been elaborated further by Daniel Baumesh and Mason Bacatishly, and also Andrew Gromov, that describe another phenomenology of the type 1 fractals. And also, you can use them to sort of describe type 2, but OK. And then there's this approach from Xie Chen's group that define a new way to sort of look at the equivalence of faces as a foliated topological order. So I want to sort of just to bring attention to another way to look at it, that is to emphasize the role of translation symmetry in these models. And if you actually go back and read, say, Johan Haar's thesis, it's incredibly hard to penetrate, but just to appreciate that he really uses translation symmetry in a smart and a profound way. You don't need to read the whole thesis. You see that he really uses this all throughout his formalism. Okay, and there's more recent work by Hermley and his student that sort of take this idea further to describe other fractal faces out of the world of stabilizer code. Okay, so Haar was just focusing on stabilizer code. Okay, so I want to first just briefly discuss why translation symmetry is important. Usually, when we think about topological order, we say, okay, these are let's put aside the symmetry in reach for now. So if you just think about topological order, usually you would say these are robust against any perturbation. These are not you're robust against, say, breaking and symmetry, etc. Okay, but and it's also true for fractal models. If you break translation symmetry a little bit, these energetics will not change. Okay, however, it turns out that it's very convenient to just put translation invariance to your model, and all the models we study are translation invariant. And also, it's kind of if you have a very strongly disordered system, having something with a reduced mobility is not surprising. You just have localized localization phenomena in that case. And so I'll just assume that all the models will be translation invariant. And translation invariance turns out to be a convenient tool to formalize this notion of reduced mobility. Okay, so this is let me just sort of briefly describe this. I mean, this was sure known to many people, and was the way that Haar defined, for example, Haar defined the mobility in this way. Okay, so if you have two quasi particles, So I'm sort of doing this in the conventional topological phase where we can create a pair of quadriparticles. It may not be the case in fractal models, but let's just use this as an illustration. And let's just look at this patch of system where you have two quadriparticles. And you know, how do I know whether I can move a quadriparticle or not? Okay, so that sounds like a dynamic question. No, you have to put terms to sort of induce dynamics, but you can first figure out the kinematics. So one way to do it is let's create another state which is related to a previous state by just moving this quadriparticle, say, along a lattice by one lattice spacing. And these two states locally are related by translation symmetry. So if you look at local density matrix here and here, they just differ by translation, a unit translation, for example. Now, if you want these two states, if you want to have some local operator to sort of have this state, to have this new state from a previous state for this process to happen, well, these two states better have the same quantum number. Whatever quantum number you have in the system, could be topological, could be global symmetry, it should have the same quantum number. Okay. So now there are two possibilities. One is that these two states have a different global quantum symmetry. Just the global symmetry quantum number are different for these two states related by translating one quadriparticle. Then you cannot have any local process that move this quadriparticle preserving all the symmetries. Another possibility that these two pictures or these two states just differ by topological quantum number, then in that case, just no local physical process at all can change the topological charge without creating new particles. Okay. So if these two quadriparticles turns out to be sitting in different superselection sector, then there's no way to go from one state to another. Okay. All right, so and another aspect of a fractal model that sort of, you know, highlight the role of translation is entanglement RG. So let me just say this in word. So entanglement RG means that you take your system, and when we think of RG, well, you know, first you co-screen your system. In this case, you just enlarge your unit cell by a factor of two, for example, in many of these models. And then you do some unitaries, okay, to figure out, you know, what this new model is. After you group in a unit cell, or grouping the sites in one to form a new unit cell. So it's a unitary transmission on the ground state, on the whole Hamiltonian, not just on ground state. So that's why it's called entanglement RG. And for example, for XQ model, you see this pattern of bifurcating RG. That is, you start from XQ model on a, say, L by LL lattice, but now you group a unit cell. Okay. Well, you start from something on 2L by 2L by 2L lattice. Now you group two sites into one unit cell. Really eight sites. You just, you know, change your length scale by a factor of two. And then you perform a number of unitary operations. That's this equivalence means that you perform some number of unitaries, local unitary transformations that will transform this Hamiltonian into X cube plus a bunch of topic code. Okay. So if you do this in the conventional topological order, you just get a fixed point. The topological order is invariant under RG after you have done a finite number of co-screening. Okay. So TC here just means toric code, a stack of toric code. Okay. So there's also Haar's bifurcating RG for the cubic code, which is, if you do it, you get Haar's code back plus a B model, which is then self-bifurcating. Okay. So just to show another example that we recently did, so actually Haar has 17 models. And one of them become famous because it's actually the most symmetric one. But if you open his paper, he has 17 models. He basically classified all possible models you could ever write down on the cubic lattice with two spin per site, okay? With some assumptions, but it's actually quite mild assumptions. So he even provided mathematical code along with his paper for you to play with RG. I think before us, probably the number of download of that file was exactly zero. So you can do this. And then for the 11th cubic code, I mean, just to show example, so you see an even more complicated, slightly more complicated pattern of entanglement RG that you get the same model back, plus stack of toric code, plus a different model, and different model bifurcates further, cell bifurcates further. Okay.
So, yeah. What are the beam models in those two?
So what I know is that this B model is self-bifurcating. So if you is self-bifurcating, meaning that if you further do RG on the B model, it splits into two copies of itself.
Oh, I see.
So that means, for example, the ground state degeneracy will be doubling if you double it. Well, the number of qubits encoded in the system will be doubled. Unlike Haar's code, you know, it's less irregular than Haar's code, but still like a fractal model. Okay. So in this case, the B model turns out to be a Lyapunov model, meaning that there's a particle moving in line, but then it's also fractal in some other way. Like the models that are written down by Benny Yoshida, but not exactly. I mean, it has similar phenomenology. Okay. So we have done many of these exercises. And increase the download of Haar's mathematical by quite a significant number. But the point of this is that, well, of course, you know, usually we would take this as a way to, well, as an indication that you have to, you know, define what it means by RG fixed point differently, right? So now this is not a simple RG fixed point. So for example, what Xie proposed is that you should just throw away this part and to define new notion of fixed point, okay? But you could take this slightly differently and just say, okay, so these are really exactly the same Hamiltonian, just differ by local unitary transformation. Okay, so it's really the same Hamiltonian. I haven't done really any integrating out anything. I haven't done anything. It's just the same Hamiltonian. But the only difference is that here, the translation symmetries, lattice scale is defined differently. So I have Z cross Z translation, but here it's the double translation. So it means that depending on how you define the translation symmetry in exactly the same model, you would identify the phase differently. So the nature of the phase somehow relies on how you, if you take this point of view, somehow relies on how you actually define translation symmetry in the system. Okay, so just, you know, I just want to use this as a teaser to why I, you know, why it's sort of useful sometimes to think about translation symmetry in this kind of models. All right, I probably spent too much time on this, but okay, so try to move fast. So first, I'll take this lesson we learned from the fractal models that, you know, you should think about reduced mobility as a topological phenomenon, and also that's tied to translation symmetry, and come back to sort of a conventional, more conventional topological order, the U1 spin liquid, and see, you know, what I learned here. So many of the things in this part actually have shown up in Andre's talk already, so, but in different language. So let's just know that you are in the right conference. Okay, so let me again come back to this Zn Torricelli model that, you know, we've seen again and again. I still can learn something, slightly new things from this. So I've defined a string operator where you have a bunch of Zs that create the E particle. Okay, so this model has a number of internal symmetries. Again, this has shown up in Yuanming's talk for the Z2 version. So if you just take all the edges, this E here means edge, not the E excitation. If you take all the edges along X and just multiply the X together, you see that Hamiltonian is actually invariant under this X. Okay, so this is a global symmetry, just a spin flip in this problem. I call it R. And now notice that this string that creates the E excitations, a bunch of Zs, so each of them, well, Zs don't commute with X, and each of them gives you a phase, an nth root of unity. So if you create a pair of E excitations and separate them in X direction, say by a length of L, then the eigenvalue of this R symmetry is actually E to 2 by I over N times LX. Okay? So it really means that this E carries, in a way, the Zn dipole moment. And another way of saying this is the translation do not commute with the global symmetry on the E particle. If you move it, and then you measure the R charge, you get a different answer as compared to you measure it first and then you move. Okay. Because the strings actually are charged under the global symmetry. Okay, so this is not true fractons because, well, you can just move it by n steps and then you get back exactly the same global quantum number. This is Zn charge. So in this model, you can move it by n steps. Okay, so it turns out that if you think about translation symmetry for any 2D anions and with some other global symmetry, it always turns out to be this way, that you can move things by finite steps. So at least in conventional two-dimensional gap topological spaces with global symmetries, there are no true fractals. You can always move things by just going in some n steps. Okay. All right, so this is essentially because of the finite number of particle types you have. So there's no way you get infinite number of particle types. Okay. But then you may say, how do I sort of upgrade this to a true fractal? Well, one obvious thing to do is just to take n to infinity. And that's a U1 gauge theory. Okay, but we know U1 gauge theory is not, compact U1 gauge theory is confining 2D, so let's go to 3D. And well, this is a standard, just the textbook way of writing down a lattice U1 gauge theory in 3D, where you have a Gauss law on each side. I put a rotor on each edge. E is electric field, the integer value electric field, and A is gauge potential. So this is just a rotor. And then you apply Gauss law to each vertex, and then there's also cosine of curve of A term on each bucket. Okay, so you write on Hamiltonian. I write it as a spin model, as a rotor model, because the Gauss law is enforced by energetics, but we can take delta infinity. Then there's a term E squared, just to give it some dynamics. Okay. And we know that for small values of U, this is in a Coulomb phase, so you have gapless photons. And again, you can easily write down this sort of dipole-like global symmetry, which is just a sum of all the E's along some direction. Okay? And you just sum all of them up. This is a charge. This is a U1 charge that commutes with Hamiltonian, each term in a Hamiltonian. Okay?
Yeah. Can I go back?
Sure. We'll go back to...
So the fact that, let's say, on a translation, the anion changes type.
Right.
How much does that really matter? After all, translation is not a local operation, right?
So yeah, but when we talk about how particles move, right? We usually think about you have this state related by translation symmetry, and you try to form eigenstate, say a plane wave eigenstate, but these states actually, although they have same density matrix related by translation, but they actually have different superposition sector, then you cannot form such. You cannot superpose them. And also means that you cannot have local operator that connects them, which is just another way of saying there's no string operator connecting them. Okay, but no. Okay, so and this is just a dipole. This is really just a dipole moment of a pair of E charges in this compact U1 gauge theory. If you separate these two particles by two E excitations by a length L, then along X, and it has the eigenvalue of S of X just equal to the separation between them. Okay. So it means that if you try to move this E particle, you have to apply operator that violate this S of X conservation, which is a dipole conservation in this problem, now implemented as a global symmetry. So this also has shown up in a number of other works. And just to make connection to this, the actual spin models that can be related to U1 gauge theory, so just very briefly, so this is a spin model. Basically, the SZ is identified with E field, and then these guys are S plus and minus are related to the A, E of IA. Then this dipole of U1, in this particular way of writing on U1 spin liquid, is just a staggered SZ charge. It's staggered spin Z component. Okay. Okay. So clearly, this is sort of a fracton behavior, but now protected by enforced by a global symmetry. And if you promote this to a gauge symmetry, not surprisingly, you get the true fracton behavior. And then you get, so we can actually show just in the lattice model directly that if you gauge this all these three U1 symmetries, I define three U1 symmetries to sort of restrict motion in three directions, then the three U1s, if you gauge all of them, you can identify a sector in this new theory, which is a flux-free sector of the original theory that's just exactly the same as a symmetric tensor gauge theory with a 1-1 scalar charge in the language of this paper by Daniel Bamish and Mason Pakashi. Okay. They define the tensor gauge theory on lattice. Okay, so now we can sort of abstract a little bit and say, all right, let's just think about this problem of U1 gauge theory with translation and with global U1 symmetry. So in the previous case, these global U1 symmetries are the dipole conservations, but we can just say there's some global U1. And we can try to ask, you know, what are the possible ways that I can implement these symmetries in the interesting way that, you know, give me something that looks like fractons or et cetera. Okay. So one thing, I mean, I have to probably skip this part, that is, you know, we know that U1 gauge theory has this duality symmetry group, which just tells you all the possible ways that you can relabel electric magnetic charges, preserving all the properties, universal properties, not the non-universal ones. And this is really the SL2Z group. And if you generate, if you give me a U1 gauge theory with some global symmetry group G, just abstractly at level of sort of effective theory, then you can classify different ways that the Gs can be implemented in the theory by sort of doing two things. One is you have to tell me how the row, this global symmetry G, is mapped into the duality symmetry group. It could just map to a trivial element, just doesn't permute any charges. It could map to non-trivial element like charge conjugation. Okay. And then once you further do that, you have to further specify how G acts on each individual quadriparticles, and this is known as the symmetry fractionalization, which also heard about in Yuanming's talk in 2D. It's a well-understood case, but you know, we can also do this for 3D U1 spin liquid. And this was done by, masters of U1 spin liquids in this room, all of them in the room. OK, so first, a duality symmetry. So you can actually carry on this program and try to classify all the ways that this can be done. And one conjecture, let's say, I consider this a conjecture, that is all the symmetry in rich U1 gauge theories are gauge SPT faces. So there's no other way to get symmetry in rich U1 gauge theory other than just gauging a U1 symmetry in some SPT face, symmetry protected topological face. But actually, that means you have to find in your charge lattice, so this is just lattice where I plot all the different charges on integer points. This is an E charge, this is M charge, electric charge, magnetic charge, I can plot it on this lattice. It means that you have to have a line in this lattice which is fixed by whatever symmetry you have. So that restricts this mapping from the global symmetry to a duality symmetry group to be the following things. So we can just solve this equation. There's some SL2Z matrix acting on one of charge and remain on this line. Okay? And just solving this, you get this condition, A plus D is plus minus 2. So it's a trace 2 matrix. Trace plus minus 2 matrix. And you can also show that all such matrices in SL2Z are conjugate to just, you know, the modular transformation, the T element, to some power. It could be T to 0, that's identity, or minus 1, that's a charge conjugation. Like, it can also be T to nth. Okay. All right, and then, so it means that, for example, translation could be mapped to identity, doesn't change any charge, could be mapped to a charge conjugation, could be mapped to a charge conjugation, like in many U1 spin liquids that you write down using parton constructions, or it could be mapped to a module transformation. Okay. So when this is the identity transformation, then the fractionalization is classified by second cohomology of U1 coefficients. This is really just projective representations on the charge. Okay. And in this case, you can calculate Z3 times U1. So that's a symmetry group that we choose. And then you get three Zs. So the three Zs are exactly the dipole charges you could have in the problem. So now I can, and then you have to do this for each, for both electric and magnetic charges. So I have two projective reps that tells you how the electric and magnetic charges transform under a global symmetry, projectively. But in this particular problem where Z is actually interpreted as a translation symmetry, this is nothing but a mobility constraint under the dipole conservation. Okay. So you have two integer vectors that tells you if you, say, separate a pair of E charges by a distance via vector R, then this global U1 charge of this state is the vector times the R. Okay, so that's the meaning of this vector. It's a vector, so it has three Zs, and that's classification. Okay, so lattice model that we just discussed realized a case where the monopole doesn't really do anything, but electric charge actually has a non-trivial V vector here, the mobility vector. Yeah.
I should probably. Quadratic translation?
No, this is a usual translation, the ordinary translation. Otherwise, I wouldn't write Z3.
Yeah, the project rep of Z to Z cubed.
Well, this is a projected rep between Z and U1.
You only count that.
Yeah. Okay, so because I'm assuming rho is 1, so there's no projected rep for the Z alone, right? Anyway, we know that fact. So. Yeah, there's a magnetic translation, but it's a continuous parameter, and we can tune it to 0. Okay, so, and then the natural question is, can we have both of these vectors non-zero? No, we just show the lattice model. I mean, the one that you can just write down has one of vector 0. I mean, doesn't matter which one it is. So, no, this is probably familiar to many of you in the room. That is, if you want to discuss some symmetry fractionality pattern, you have to worry about the Tooth anomaly in this problem. Otherwise, this state doesn't exist in 3 plus 1. It has to exist on surface of 4 plus 1. Okay. So we, this is something ongoing that is, hopefully we can finish this soon, that we calculate the Tooth anomaly in such a gauge theory. And turns out to have a compact expression in terms of the projective reps of electric magnetic charges. But you can go and just calculate this thing, and you find that its obstruction only vanishes if these two vectors, the cross product of these two vectors are 0. Okay? So just run through this calculation, that's what you get. Okay? So it has two possibilities. One is that one of them is 0, and the other one can be whatever. Then that's the case that we have seen so far. And in this case, it means the bosonic, all the magnetic bosonic E or M particle transforms completely trivially under the symmetry, and that one you can identify as a matter of SPT phase. Okay. The other case is that both of them non-zero, but they are parallel. Then the cross product is 0. Okay. In that case, the dion E dagger M would be a trivial particle. I mean, symmetry, trivial under a symmetry transformation. So how would I realize such a thing? Well, here's a proposal. So you take 2D quantum Hall states, not the integer quantum Hall states, but a bunch of 2D quantum Hall states that I'm going to specify what exactly they are. And you stack them. These are quantum Hall, so they have some global U1 symmetry, and you gauge it. These are quantum Hall of fermions, so they are fermionic quantum Halls. And then you gauge it, you get a U1 gauge theory with fermionic charge. Okay. So the quantum Hall that I need to put in here has this simple form, so it's the K matrix abelian transignments that describe quantum Hall is just 1 minus 1 with these two charge vectors. And more importantly, there's a Hall response between the global symmetry and the symmetry that I'm going to gauge. Okay, that is a quantum Hall I'm going to put in the system. Now, if you're putting a pair of M particles in the system, there's a 2 pi flux line sort of connecting them. And when it penetrates each quantum Hall state, it picks up a global charge of 2. Given by the response. And that means if you try to separate these two particles, you get a global symmetry, which is also the case that we just discussed. But now, because I'm putting in a fermionic quantum Hall, this is related to a previous case that I want to construct by a module transformation. All right, so sort of rushing through this part, but I hope there's just to. I think the basic point that there's something, still something to be learned about U1 gauge theory, I mean, the vector U1 gauge theory, after we know there's this phenomenology of fractals.
Well, let me make sure I understand. So can you go back one slide?
Sure.
So you're saying you stack these layers of quantum spin Hall, basically?
Yeah, basically, U1 cross U1 spin
quantum Hall. One of the U1.
Yeah, which is a fermion number.
I see. OK, so then the monopole of that gauged U1 have a hard time moving, the global U1 charge keeps changing.
Yeah, right. Okay, so now I'm going to sort of switch gears and talk about another type of fractal models that we are, that sort of have a layer structure, similar to the previous slide. You see that we can gauge some global symmetry in a layer system to get an interesting space. To motivate this construction, let me come back to the ZN toric code. Okay, so this is just a copy from a previous slide. You have the ZN, and then these are the string operators. Okay, so I just said that this particular symmetry, the product of all the x along the x edge, is sort of interesting respect to the z, well, respect to e particle, because the z's don't commute with x. Okay, and one quick way to see that is that this symmetry is nothing but the product of string operators along y directions for each of these paths. Okay. You have a bunch of M strings, and we know E and M have non-trivial breeding, so if you try to move the E through these strings, well, each time you pick up a face, okay, so that way it has a hard time moving. Okay, so, but we know actually this model has a lot more symmetry than just that. It has a one-form symmetry, actually. I mean, I'm using one-form symmetry in the loose sense because Heinrich's series probably wouldn't agree with my way of using one-form symmetry, but I'm going to use it anyway. So one-form symmetry here, I'm just referring to the Wilson loop. In this case, the M loop. You can just apply an M to a ground state and nothing changes. And in this case, actually, this operator even commutes with a whole Hamiltonian, not just ground state, acting on ground state. Okay. So more generally, if you have a topological order phase, just in two dimensions, this is a 2D conventional topological order phase, and you have a abelian anion, you can form a Wilson loop of the abelian anion, and then this is a one-form symmetry, meaning that it commutes at least at low energy with a Hamiltonian, with the dynamics. Okay, so if this A has order n, meaning that if you fuse n of n numbers of A, you get an identity, then this is a Z of n of A one-form symmetry. Okay. And another slogan is that if you gauge this one-form symmetry, it's the same as condensing the anion in the problem. One, this is a bosonic anion. And the one-form symmetry way of saying that is this one-form symmetry is not anomalous.
So, can this, so this loop, take an anion and an anti-anion, move it around and...
Right,
So I can't detect it, can I detect it non-locally or?
You mean can I detect it, this loop non-locally? Yeah. Well, this is a generator of a symmetry, right? So this doesn't really create any excitation in the system. So what we can do is that you can wrap it around another particle, then you can pick up charge. Well, this particle pick up charge under this A. Okay. So yeah, anyway, this probably doesn't answer a question, but I don't think you can detect it locally without other global symmetry. So you can wrap this loop around another anion. Well, you know, this is just braiding, but you can also say, just in this language, that this particle is charged under one-form symmetry. Has a pickup phase, and depending on the phase, if this phase is not one, then B is charged under one-form symmetry. Okay, so if you restrict the one-form symmetry, I mean, one-form symmetry means that you can put a loop of any shape, and it commutes with Hamiltonian, but if you just restrict them to straight lines, well, we also call them subsystem symmetries in this case. So let me now just place these lines, forming a grid in the system. I'm only considering one-form symmetries now sort of placed along these lines. And then I get a grid of this one-form symmetry, these Wilson loops. And if something is charged under the one-form symmetry in the sense that I just defined, then if you try to move across this grid, you have to pick up faces every time you cross these Wilson lines. Okay. So in this case, I can just pick any theta, any particle which are either fermions or bosons, and these lines will commute. So I can define them as global symmetry group. Okay. And you have to be, more technical thing that these have to be one on-site one-form symmetries in the sense that defined recently by Xiaogang. But anyway, this is a bit like tautological in the sense that if you enforce these 1D lines like symmetry, you cannot really move anything. I mean, but this is, you might say this is a very contrived situation, right? I'm putting all these 1D lines forming this grid, and each of the particles have to be confined to the grid as long as it's charged under the one-form symmetry. And you might say, let's gauge these 1D symmetries to make it less contrived, but gauging a one-dimensional symmetry is not very interesting. Usually it just breaks a system into strips. Okay, so we can make it a little more interesting by promoting the whole system to 3D by doing this. Okay, just form a stacks of layers, and in each layer, I have this one line of Wilson. This is the Wilson line, and then I also stack these Wilson lines to form a membrane. Okay, so this is just really a bunch of Wilson lines, but now stacked to form a surface, and then this is a 2D surface. So this is a planar symmetry. And now I can gauge a 2D symmetry, and we know from the other studies of XQ models, et cetera, that gauging a 2D symmetry could be interesting. and can lead you to a topological order phase. Okay. So just to summarize that, in his case, I am defining a 2D symmetries in this stacked layer of topological order states in 2D as a product of these one-dimensional Wilson lines. And I have to form two such planes. And then they'll produce anionic fractons. OK, so this is a general procedure that can be carried out in any two-dimensional topological order phases as long as you find a bosonic or fermionic Wilson lines. I'll just take a few, couple more minutes. Okay. And gauging, for example, and this gauging can be done in rather standard ways. For example, if you just take the toric code example that I just gave you, and then you can form these layers of toric code, and then you put gauge fields in plaquette of toric code. You put two gauge fields on each plaquette, and also put these additional gauge fields on the side surfaces. And then you can just use a minimal coupling scheme to write down the gauged model. Okay, and then it turns out that okay, you restrict to some subspace where the Gauss law is enforced strictly, and then et cetera, you get exactly the X cube model. This is probably not too surprising because X cube model is a result you get by gauging three subsystem symmetries. And here I'm just sort of doing it sequentially. I first gauge one, I get toric code, and then gauge the other two, I get X cube. But now we can do something more interesting. Okay. So for example, well, I'm just going to skip all introductions to Levine-Wynn model. But anyway, we can put non-abelian model here, and the one that I'm going to put it is a doubled Ising model, which is just Ising cross Ising conjugate. And then there are nine type of anions. Ising topological order has three, so one sigma and psi, and you can form any combination of them to give you nine anions. One of them is a boson, which is a psi-psi particle. And you can actually write down a string operator in the lattice model, in the Levine-Wynn model that corresponds to that boson. And then you can gauge, you can just use a recipe to gauge this symmetry in this construction. It's not, no, we can write down all the lattice models exactly solvable projector models. And the result you get is the following. So you have non-abelian fractons. Okay, you have non-abelian fractons. These are the descendants of the sigma particles in the problem because sigma operates non-trivially with that psi-psi. And then you have lionons just coming from these gauge fields, flux of these gauge fields. And then some other particles which break trivially, no, not charged under that one-form symmetry that I'm gauging, remain just freely moving that plane, and these are planons. Okay. So in this way, you get many, many different, I mean, infinite number of different models where you just plug in different topological order in a 2D, and then you do this. And as long as this is a topological order with a boson in it, abelian boson or fermion in it, you can do this trick, and then you get a 3D fractal model that can be shown to be somewhat interesting. It's not equivalent to, say, SQ plus a bunch of decoupled 2D layers. Okay. So I think I'm already running out of time. So now there are, on the market, there are a number of different ways that you can generalize this sort of type 1 models in different ways. And this adds one to the family that seems to be different from some of the other constructions. So adding one data point to this already quite extensive list of models, but it has a virtue that's embarrassingly simple. Okay, so I'm going to stop here, and I'll acknowledge all my collaborators. This is done in collaboration with graduate student Arpit Duar at Yale, and then my postdoc Dominic Williamson, and also Jim B at MIT. And then there's some hard calculation. Eventually, we refer to Joanne at Microsoft, so he spares some time from his busy work of building quantum computer to help us a little bit. Okay, thank you for attention.
So we have time for a few questions.
Comment on the difference between your construction and the cage.
Yeah, so I even actually wrote the words. All right, so I'll just compare this non-abelian model that I just talked about with a non-abelian cage net that was discussed in this paper. So in a cage net model, you can take a non-abelian state, a double SU to level 2, for example, and you do this cage net construction. In that case, you get abelian fracton and non-abelian lionons. So the quality particle excitation you get in these models are very different. But we feel like these models are closely related. I mean, it has, but just we couldn't quite figure out exactly how.
And here when the phantoms are not.
Phantoms are now a billion. The linons are just a billion linons like you have in the other models. Right, so it's sort of like you dump the interesting stuff to fractons in our construction, and here you put the interesting stuff to linons in their construction. And it's like one of them is a bit more like condensation, this one is like gauging. But anyway, we don't understand exactly the relation, but it seems to be closely related. And maybe some combination of these two is the most general way of constructing models. But we don't know.
Do you have to be on lattices to have these phases?
Well, so I think this construction I described, like this picture, where is it? No, at least when I draw the picture, I don't actually draw a lattice. But so this construction, I believe, is complete general, even you don't have a lattice model. This construction complete general.
Periodic potential.
It doesn't really matter as long as you have this thing, you have this Wilson line, which you have in any topological order phase. As long as you have a billion boson, you have this Wilson line. And I have to make an additional assumption that this Wilson line can be somehow written down in the local way, that you're the product of some local operators. Then you can do this.
Lattice in the third direction.
Oh, right. That's true. Yeah, you have to have somehow you have to have lattice in third direction, but I don't have to have a lattice in x, y direction. Right. Yes. But that seems to be quite common in fractons because somehow the scale has to be there. Yeah. And my starting point is sort of like, let me just impose a discrete translation from the beginning just to talk about these things.
What is the precise relation between one-form symmetry and subsystem symmetry?
So here I have to admit that I'm using it in a very superficial way. I'm just restricting one-form symmetry to a line. But maybe something slightly more interesting that, for example, gauging the whole one-form symmetry would kill the whole thing. But only gauging it along this rigid surface give you a fractal model. So it seems like you can probably take this further, but I don't know. But this, at least this construction sort of suggests that there's maybe some deeper relation between them.
Okay, so.
Yeah.